Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 132 with Sakar Kale on building a 200-unit portfolio in Baltimore, Maryland. Sakar and I discuss his journey from a 9-to-5 job early on to building a portfolio of more than 200 units over the last 15 years. He shares a wealth of experience ranging from the best mindset to deal with your contractors to the benefits of owning a scaled real estate investment portfolio and why you should, and even some gems outside of real estate. I had a blast creating this episode, and I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to the show, Sakar. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me, Dan. I appreciate it.
Nice. So just to give the REI Diamond Show listeners some background on who you are, if they're not in the Baltimore area that you're currently dominating with your portfolio and investment activities, do you want to give the Reader's Digest version about how you got in real estate, maybe a brief what your career looked like and the things you're doing today?
Absolutely. And again, thank you for having me, Dan. I am Sakar Kavle. I am a typical immigrant story. I came from India for my master's. I studied at Clemson University from 97 to 98, and I had a typical career path like millions of other immigrants where, you know, they are taking professional education and getting into jobs and things like that. So where my story actually ended with real estate started with real estate is that I got employed in 1999 and I had a layoff from my good IT job in 2001. And that planted a bug wherein I wanted more control on my future. And through that, I started, avenue as to, hey, how can I, have a consistent passive income where I don't have to depend on my day job? And that brought me basically to real estate. And I had some background of real estate as well from India, where my family is heavily invested in a lot of other asset classes within real estate as well. So there was like a combination of those things. And that was coupled with when I moved to Baltimore. And Baltimore is known to, as a good cash flowing town. And so far at this point, we have about a couple of hundred cash flowing rentals, like mid-size apartments, a lot of single family houses, duplexes, and, you know, everything in between. They're all, you know, very much renovated and cash flowing at this point.
Cool. Yeah, it's one heck of a portfolio there, 200, 300, couple hundred were your exact words. I assume there's 200 plus in there.
Right. I think we are clocking, if my last check was like about 196 is what we have.
Isn't that funny how when you get to a certain volume, it's like you're not even sure how many houses you even own?
That is true, Dan, because it's just a shifting a sort of number because we are acquiring all the time. So sometimes we don't even have a count on, how many we are acquiring because a lot of stuff is in flight usually, you know.
Just curious, do you invest in stocks at all, Sakar?
I don't. I don't invest in stocks at all. I took quite a beating on my stock portfolio way back during the 2000 era. So I've been through a few crashes like that. And, my pension towards stock market has reduced considerably.
Agreed. So the reason I ask is early on in my real estate career, I've been at it since 2006, but I remember looking at a single house. I was 26 years old, no money to my name. I didn't even have the layoff. It was just not a good situation for me. But for me, it was like, man, if I could just have like one rental property, or if I could just get like maybe two or three, or, you know, flip a house, you know, everything would just be great. And I remember looking at that first one, like it was like so humongous and like it was going to solve all my problems. And it did solve a lot of problems. And I figured out, the next problem was figuring out how to do more of them. I did have some good mentors who were pushing me in my mindset toward doing volume, which is exactly the path that you did as well. The reason I asked the stock question was to tie it in. I own personally a small little basket of stocks. I did it intentionally to look at that market and just to maybe acquire or expose myself to a different set of stimuli by reviewing stocks and taking a look at it and seeing if I could understand those assets, just to broaden my own mindset in general. The unintended lesson that I was able to put into real estate is that you're buying stocks and some are going to be winners, some are going to be losers. And you're buying usually like a large number of stocks to mitigate the risk. And I was able to take that mindset lesson from, you know, the last few years of the stocks and sort of equate that to what I should or would I do. And I would imagine someone like you was doing with 196 plus units, give or take. And that is, you have like a multiple variety of these different assets. Some are duplexes, some are multifamily, some are single family, and some are performing better than others. And some are being sold because they don't really fit anymore, and you're acquiring new ones that you think are going to be better. Do you remember early on as you maybe started to get that like volume mindset, did you initially set out to get 196 units, or was there a point when you bought a second, a third house, or maybe a newer listener on the line right now, Sakar, you know, eavesdropping on our conversation, is maybe at a point where they're like less than 10 units and they're maybe struggling with or looking at that mindset shift toward volume? Can you remember that even for your own career? Maybe shed some insight on that for other people that would be at the same challenge?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that's a great question, Dan. And where I want to maybe highlight everyone is that scale, you know, gives you some forgiveness. And what I mean by that is that, you know, few houses may not be doing great. You know, they may not be cash flowing initially, but your end goal that, okay, if you hold them long enough, they will come out of that a bad patch. And sometimes, you know, we do end up, you know, let's say you're someone is, you know, doing renovations and things like that. Things happen, you know, you have overages. So those things do happen. But typically in a rental situation, typical life cycle is that, you know, you renovate and you rent. So initially, you don't have a whole lot of cash flow because, you know, you're just coming out of a huge renovation and things like that. But once you start to acquire scale, scale is the way to go, that you got to acquire scale so that you can afford your own to keep things down. And plus, more importantly, you learn best practices as well, that what to do, what not to do. Hey, this worked, that worked. A lot of this business also is about knowing the right neighborhoods as to where to buy. And that's kind of our sort of the few nuggets that you should always implement in your business, is that always remember why people would be living. People live in a neighborhood first, and then they live in a house. So the idea that you want to have a good house in a good neighborhood, if you flip that coin, for example, if you have a bad house in a good neighborhood, you will still do well. But for example, if you have a good house in a not so good neighborhood, you wouldn't be doing well. So as you are achieving scale, that's the mantra, that you want to know good neighborhoods and you sort of multiply your acquisitions during those. And, you know, and then, you know, as you go on adding more and more units, you are more knowledgeable about what's happening around the area and things like that. And, as obviously you alluded to that, if there are certain houses that may not be doing well, you basically sell off or not buy in those areas. You move to better areas. And I always say this, is that you have to do the right thing everywhere, like whether it's your tenants, contractors, lenders, like that. I think this is a very business where if you're doing the right thing for the long haul, it's easy to scale up at that point.
Yeah, you're right about that. And the scale, I guess that's basically, I wrote that down. That's a huge takeaway if anyone didn't catch that. The scale provides forgiveness. Over time, the real estate will do better. And that's not necessarily every. If you overpay for a property in the wrong area and it's negative cash flow to the point you're going to be bankrupt, I mean, there's a limit to that. But I guess I bought my first, or I bought four or five or six rentals all at once. I think I had like one or two. And I bought these six, and they had bad tenants, and I had to churn through them, and I hated the rentals at first. I hated them, and I felt like I overpaid for them. They were in the areas where, for me, it was a growth area in Philadelphia, and some of the listeners have heard me talk about that small portfolio purchase. But, you know, 3-4 years after I buy them, the rents are up, they're stable, and the values have increased by 30-40% or more, depending on the block. And I now am living the lesson of, you know, having the scale. It was like if I had bought one property, I wouldn't have been able to continue making maybe the payment off of the cash flow coming in off the others while I was doing the evictions and the turnovers. And so I totally grasped the scale. I don't remember if you mentioned it in the intro, but I know a little bit about you from before in our other conversations. So it's a loaded question, I know the answer to, and that's you also do or have done like a ton of fix and flip renovations, making some cash, just retailing properties in addition to the cash flow holds, right, Sakar?
Actually, it's the other way there, Dan, is that back in the years, Dan, that when I was full-time employed, we had already recognized that buy and hold is one of the strong pillars to long-term wealth. And through observations, I had found that typically a lot of the renovators and things like that will slowly start adding buy and hold rental properties to their portfolio. So my philosophy always was that keep on, you know, adding rentals to my portfolio. And again, that was also dictated by the fact that I had a full-time job. I did not want myself to be exposed to, you know, sort of the vagaries and up and downs of the market. So we did not pursue sort of the flipping side of the business. We were always about, you know, buying a great neighborhood, renovate the property in a top shape, and then rent it to the tenants. So that has been our model, and that has given us great benefits where our renovations, the way we renovate them, they have withstood the test of time. And now we have properties where, even if someone vacates, it's easy just do a paint job without doing a whole lot of renovation, and we are able to re-rent those properties. So that has been our sort of model of how we have done the business. And there is a big lesson to be learned as to how to do the renovations and what's the right way to, renovate these properties for the long haul. And, that probably is a tangent by itself. But that's really the secret to success, is that you renovate the properties in a very good manner so that properties are never a question for a tenant, whether your properties are good enough to qualify for a tenant. It really becomes a question that whether you really want that tenant prospect walking in the door, whether you really, like them, whether they will qualify to rent your properties and things like that. And, once you start, doing a lot of these, there are a lot of, best practices you can implement. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. The same set of contractors you can leverage to do those things. And, it just starts to become simpler, basically, in terms of, you don't have to pull too many hairs during your renovations. And, sort of the system starts to become a roll on an autopilot, basically.
So in my properties, I didn't buy and then renovate most of them. Most of them I bought kind of turnkey. And one of my own strategies lately is if I have a property that's gone up in value and it's a single family, I'll sell that off. I might add some additional cash and I'm going to put the 20% down, and I want to get, a 5, a 6, an 8, a 10 unit building with a 1031 exchange. That was kind of the latest deal that I did. But as these properties go and need repairs, so I have a property that something with the bathroom floor and the toilet was wobbling, and they gave me the repair estimate. Oh, we're going to fix the area around the around the toilet, and it's going to be like $800. And I had the sense, because I'm construction oriented background a little bit, to ask, well, instead, you know, can I have an estimate to get property management handles this for me, to get the entire bathroom floor done with ceramic tile? And I'm very specific in wanting that more durable, properly installed flooring, even though it's going to cost me maybe twice the price that it would cost to do the temporary repair, because I know then I can come back and I could just pop in like a new vanity if I need to. And it's, you know, I'm kind of looking toward the long term. Are there materials or renovation decisions that are specific that you would share with the audience that you've learned along the way that might kind of have those longevity benefits, as opposed to like maybe putting like cheaper stuff?
Absolutely. I think you did hit as far as the bathroom floors that you just pointed out. You rightfully hit a nail on the head there. Is that like when we are renovating the bathrooms, always make sure that you have a tile floor. And there's a specific way you can do a tile floor, is that you want to use like a cement board or a tile hardy pack, as they call it, so that it gives you a strong subsurface below the tile. You don't want to be doing any type of some people, as crazy as it may sound, they will lay down like a 1/4 quarter of an inch of plywood and go with sort of a tile over it, and that's really not a way to do. What you really want to be doing is that you don't want vinyl, you don't want any VCT, which is like another composite tiles. You really want like strong porcelain tiles with a subfloor of cement board. Another thing we do all the time is that your bathroom surrounds, never go with a fiberglass option. You again want to do a porcelain tile surround all over the bathroom. Going back to basements, same thing. You want to have basements. If you have basements, you want to make sure your basement floors are all tiles, so that any occasional rainwater or any flooding that may happen due to plumbing and things like that, they don't, ruin your floors. Like if you have wood floors, it is very easy to buy a sander from Home, basically rent a sander from Home Depot, sand those floors, put a coat of stain and polyurethane, and pop those floors up with a limited amount of experience from a lot of handymen. People can do that. I think the real trick in sanding those floors is that the rotary sandpaper that comes for these sanders, you have to use specific, whether it's a 120 or 140 number of paper that you have to use. That's what you have to use. Going back to, again, kitchens, if you're like typically in Baltimore, around where we invest, the houses are older. So a lot of times we get into situations where a lot of things need replacements. So we are also replacing all the kitchen cabinets, and just to take our kitchen to another level, we will do like a nice backsplash. Some of our kitchens also have granite, but sometimes, if you are not going to that level of granite, you can just do a nice a laminate countertop that also works fine. But the idea is that you always have new materials. Do these things, mostly like hard surfaces, no carpets on your floors. For safety purposes, if your budget allows, you can do hardwired smoke detectors as well, so that from a safety standpoint, you are covered there as well. And other things we always do is have electrician check out all the outlets, make sure everything is grounded. If something needs replacement, just replace them ahead of time. Same thing for plumbing as well. It's not that difficult for maintenance people to do any elementary, plumbing repairs and things like that. So once those things are taken care of, you are, I think, good for the long haul.
Again, in older properties like what we have, the housing stock in Baltimore, we lead is a very legitimate concern. So there is a lead remediation that typically is done. So in that context, what we do is have lead inspector do initial inspection. They will tell us what items need to be addressed, whether, you know, we need to replace any moldings. Are there any, you know, metal components like outside railings or window or door lintels that needed to be wrapped up? So we'll wrap those with aluminum and things like that. And typically lead is not an issue in a lot of cities, but typically in the older housing stock, you run into those things nationwide. And, you know, a lot of renovators are experienced in how to do the lead remediation. So all of our properties are lead-free as well. So you basically, in a renovation aspect, you are basically looking for safety. Any water problems that may happen from, you know, occasional flooding and things like that, you want to have those hard surfaces. Speaking about basements, actually, like if you have like a weaker basement wall where water may be seeping in, you probably want to use hydraulic cement. If you're refinishing the basement, you probably want to do that hydraulic cement coating for first 24 inches from the floor so that you won't get water seepage right from the wall before you refinish and things like that. So those are kind of the high level tips and tricks of the trade, where if you do those things for the long term, you would not have any issues as you over the years. Like, for example, we have our portfolio for like almost 10-15 years now. So by doing this, what we find is that you are not able, you are not doing the same repairs the whole time. So let's say if the tenant moves out, all you're doing is mostly painting the house because you would have done a correct renovation years before. Those are kind of the really the secrets of success, that if you don't renovate properly, then you kind of get into that bad cycle, as I call it, where you are repairing the bathrooms and the toilets, and this, you're doing same things again and again, which could have been done, you know, years ago. And that tends to, you know, always keep you in a good situation where you're only painting it. You're not spending extra money on doing the same repairs again and again. Hope that helps, Dan.
It does, Sakar. Do you have a construction background, or did you learn all this along the way with trial and error?
That's a good question, Dan. For someone who's coming from India, I did not have a construction background in terms of how the construction methods are here in U.S. Like back in India, where I'm from, there is a strong steel and concrete construction with bricks and things like that. That's how my home was built back in 80s. But here, as you know, we are all, you know, stick built, houses, use of drywall and things like that. So I did not even know what a drywall was before. So I had to learn all these things, here as well. And, you know, as I learned sort of on the job, as I call it, it was all through my own mistakes, where we would not do a good job. And as years went by, I found out that, hey, you know what, these are the correct ways to do things. And actually the interesting thing in this also is that because you're doing this much of renovation, you tend to spend more upfront. And that's where I was saying initially, wherein, you know, during the early years, you tend to have a lesser cash flow. But then as years, like second, third years rolls by, you know, your cash flow improves. That's what I was stating, that when you're doing these renovations, you're spending, you know, lots of cash upfront. And then as you finish the renovation and the property is stabilizing, your cash flow improves. And, you know, to tie it back to your question there, Dan, is that I did not have that background. And as I learned on the job, I learned the correct ways to do it. And I quickly implemented those in my business, basically.
Yeah, and that's smart. I wanted to point that out, that you get to these large numbers like you had already talked about here in your portfolio, one deal at a time, and not to be afraid of the construction, diving in and figuring that out if you're in the early stages. Speaking of the early stages for you, Sakar, how did you go about financing the first couple, five, six, seven deals? And at what point were you free and no longer had the 9-to-5? What was the number of units? And basically, you know, quickly, how did you get to that point from the 9-to-5 job?
Sure, sure. That's an interesting question as well, Dan, is that I had initially when I started, I had about 40, 50 grand that I used my own cash at that point. And as you rightfully pointed out, I did the same thing that I quickly bought houses very quick, back to back, back to back. And I found that my cash was all used up in acquisitions and some renovations. But then I used, private hard money to do the financing. And that's the way to scale, because you want to leverage sort of financing from others and, go on multiplying from houses to houses. That's how I scaled it way back. Then I also did like a lot of purchases and things like that. I would have balance on my credit card. I would use 0% balance transfer deals from Discover to American Express to MasterCard. So I kind of did a lot of maneuvering of my own balances back then. I'm talking like 2004, 2005 and things like that. But then slowly, as my rental properties were giving me the cash flow, I was able to, just pay off a lot of not only my credit card debt. We do have a lot of, free and clear properties. So as things progressed or as years went on, we pulled some lines of credits on our cash flowing rentals that helped us finance some acquisitions. So it was a lot of combination of these things that we did. And as we all know, the market collapsed during 2008-2009 era. And it took a good 3-4 years for the inventory to be sort of cleaned up by the market. So we had a lot of foreclosures and short sales. So one of the things I realized was that I was always working with a realtor, and I decided to become a realtor so that I can own the sort of the negotiation and make quick offers and things like that. So I become a realtor myself and quickly started making offers. I quit my job in 2013. At that point, I think we had my memory, I'm trying to recall. We may be having close to 100 units at that point when I, quit my job and, we knew that we had cash flowing rentals to support us and things like that. And one of the things I also want to point out, Dan, is that my wife is a very able partner in our portfolio. So as I was working, she was also in an IT career where she would also manage. And she, in fact, was the first one to quit her job and go full time. And that's how we were able to, scale up our business that way. My wife was sort of the outside, eyes and ears looking at properties, managing renovations while I was working.
Gotcha. It makes sense. I'm wondering, how did you get to 100 units with, 30, 40 hours a week still at the job?
Absolutely.
But makes sense. Glad you put that little piece in there for us.
Absolutely. And one of the things also there, Dan, also is that that working with good contractors is a great way to scale. That you don't want to be jumping from contractors to contractors. Sometimes you want to forgive the mistakes, even if it costs you, let's say, 500, 700 bucks. If the person is good, don't worry about your little failures or little cost overages. Just take it as a sort of a learning lesson and move on and leverage those people, because those are the people who will basically go from job to job and kind of give you that insurance that you always are covered for doing those various, you know, renovations and repairs that may happen. That's how we did it, is that we used the same set of contractors and we kept them moving from houses to houses. We had a crew of about four sets of contractors that we moved from various houses when we were scaling up. And that's another way to, you know, keep this crew stable, because they can trust you that, hey, Mr. Sakar will have a job, for them, and you move them from, various renovation sites to, you know, to one to next. And that's really how you scale up, you know.
Gotcha. How did you find deals when you were scaling up, and then how has that changed, and how do you find deals in today's tighter marketplace in 2019?
Sure. So bulk of our purchases, Dan, came in that 2012 through 14, or even earlier for that matter. A lot of our portfolio scaled up during that time, where we were probably buying almost 12 to 15 deals a month. I mean, there were times when, it was crazy that I would not even know how many deals we were buying, because it was that active at that time that we would be buying. Sometimes we would not be touching those houses for a couple of months because we were busy with some other, you know, renovations. So back then, it was a lucky foreclosure era that we scaled up. But even before the market crashed, I was mostly buying off of MLS. There wasn't any secret to it, actually. Although during that market, when it crashed, we bought a lot of HUD properties, Fannie Mae HomePath properties. We bought a lot of short sales and things like that. And again, as our reputation grew, there were a lot of wholesalers who would buy properties at courthouse auction. They would in turn make some profit and, you know, just basically give the properties to us. So we definitely leveraged a lot of avenues how we bought those deals. There were some great deals we bought off of auction as well. So we definitely leveraged all those sources. Now, at this point, let's say during 2018-19, we are very selective about how much we buy, because we already have this much going on. So we are typically nowadays, we are looking for buying portfolios or like buying large apartments and things like that. That's where we have shifted our focus. And as you rightfully pointed out, Dan, that the market has changed. The prices are quite high. This is not, we are at a time where we have to be very careful and realistic about sticking to your criteria, having those correct purchases, because let's say if you're going to renovate those properties, there is no two ways about how you can, you know, cheaply do the renovation. They cost what they cost. So you have to buy it correctly, and that has to be done correctly right now, because as you said, you know, the market is pretty tight right now. So we are selectively buying those, but at a scale and capital position we are in, we are looking to buy more and more bigger deals, like portfolios. Like, for example, last year we bought a 66 unit portfolio from a retiring landlord. So those are the kind of opportunities we are looking right now.
Gotcha. So you do not self-manage. Did you ever self-manage? If so, at what point did you start to, you know, investigate property management? And maybe if you had some tips or takeaways for an investor who might be self-managing, and your experience with turning that over to professional management companies, and maybe the selection process for property management company.
Sure. So we do self-manage right now, Dan. And what we've done is that way back in 2006-2008 era, we had given it to the property management firm. And we observed that it wasn't, they were not doing a great job, although they were one of the good property management companies here in Baltimore. What we realized that is that Like, for example, since you are doing the renovation side by side, and then you have your property management also doing a similar kind of work, so you see those cost differences that, oh, geez, they are doing an inferior job but charging us more, or they are doing something that you just know because you've done so much work on the street that you just know that those practices or those methods, whatever they may be doing, are not sort of the best way to do those things. So I think somewhere in there, like around 2008, 2009, we started to do self-management, and we kept on as units came by, having contractors and renovations being done all around us helped us. Like, we did not distinguish a lot of these things where, you know, if someone is doing renovations for us, we would basically say, hey, can you maybe spend a day or two and take care of these things? And, you know, that's how we did. Now we are at a point where we are not doing a lot of those renovations. We are probably doing one or two renovations a month, and we are using a similar crew who are also helping us in our property management business as well. I mean, obviously you have the admin side of things where, you know, you're doing the accounting, any rent collections and court notices and things like that. So that's kind of your admin side. But as far as the pure maintenance of properties goes, we are using our crew to, you know, take care of these properties. And we have another set of professional electricians and, air conditioning, heating contractors who are taking care of other things. If those issues come up, we have the professional crew lined up for that. But for most of the daily maintenance things that may come up, we own a lot of equipment, as far as whether it's a plumbing snake or an aluminum brake or, you know, a lot of other equipment that comes up. We have invested that capital into having that that equipment in house for us, and we are able to, you know, really do a good job. Turnaround is quicker, and there is a great cost benefit that comes if you self-manage, because as you may know now from my story now, Dan, is that all of our properties are renovated. So we are not getting the volume of calls daily. We may be getting like one or two maintenance requests a day. So given the size of portfolio and the amount of calls we get, there's hardly any. So for us to give out property management to an outside firm, it does not make any cost sense for us to do that kind of, a management structure. So we do it in-house, and, it helps us, keep our costs down, basically.
Yeah, and that's actually a similar thing that I've seen a lot of people do, where they're working the 9-to-5 and they've got, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 units. Makes sense kind of at that point. But when you get to 100, 120, 150, all of a sudden, you know, the cost that you'd be paying to the professional management firm, you can afford to pay somebody full time and, you know, handle most of the details of that, if not even handle it yourself at that point, since you're not working on the 9-to-5. Cool. Interesting. Are there any takeaways? Are there any questions I forgot to ask that maybe in the last 3 or 4 years you've had some really big aha light bulb moments anywhere surrounding, you know, tenant base, property type, a little shift in your strategy? Have there been anything like that in the last couple of years that, you know, have been real growth moments you could share with the audience?
Sure. I think one of the great things I always say is that always keep learning, whether it's books, podcasts like your podcast, Dan. I mean, I have personally listened to your prior podcast. You do a great job in having various guests and things like that. So it's that education and learning component that you have to do. And I'm a big proponent of networking with other people and like-minded people who are perhaps smarter than you to, you know, sort of elevate your game. And you can read a lot of books, listen to a lot of podcasts, but networking with real people, whether it's in your RIA meetings or meetups and things like that, once you network, you realize that how different nuances or different strategies other people may be doing. And that helps you, you know, sort of shift your mind that, oh, geez, you know what, that may, that is what is working. Let me implement that in your business. So that, like, I clearly remember back in 2009 and 10 when I would network a lot with my fellow investors, and kind of understand where they are investing, what kind of things they were doing. Those all came from real learning from other peer group. There's no such thing as, you know, you kind of sit in your own environment and just do your own thing without learning from other people. I think you would be doing a great disservice to that. So that's the biggest takeaway that I would say. Then obviously you can sort of dovetail off of that into where you are buying your properties, you know, what are the strategies you may be doing and things like that. But that's really the core, that you want to learn and network and grow your mindset. That's really the basics of a lot of that learning that has come out of it.
I appreciate that you share that angle of it. That's not even what I expected, but it is so pertinent. And for me, the always keep learning part, yes, it's obvious, like, oh, do you own any real estate books? Oh, do you, you know, do the real estate networking events are great places to meet people who know other contractors, tips on the neighborhoods, things that are going on. And that's, I think, some of the obvious stuff. But for me, I've noticed two things I want to share. One, my always keep learning diet of information, if you will. Sometimes I get full. And I've noticed that I'll have these cycles, these ups and downs, the ebb and flow of the tide of my hunger for knowledge and information. Right, Sakar? And some of the people who are listening to the podcast right now are probably nodding their head up and down thinking, yeah, Dan, you haven't been quite as consistent with the podcast. It's not every week like it used to be. And that's part of the reflection of the up and down of the cycle, if you will, partially of my business and getting busy and then being able to, you know, take time out and, you know, talk with you, Sakar, and invite you on the show and all the other guests I've had on the show. There's a ebb and flow, and there's a time when the sponge is full, you know, of my learning, and I have to kind of take a break. And then sometimes when it dries out again, I have to remember, like, all right, let's get back to it and keep learning. And I think that to keep it exciting, like I shared about with the knowledge exploration in the stock market earlier in our episode here, I'll sometimes intentionally take on some other angles, read books about businesses that aren't necessarily related to the real estate business, even though that's what I do 100% is all real estate related, and I'm able to pull and take lessons from a lot of other places in life to keep it going.
Actually,
if that makes sense.
One thing I may share, Dan, also is that I think a lot of people get too bottled up in real estate. I think you have to elevate your game and think yourself as an entrepreneur. And what I mean by that is that you always keep your mind open to opportunities. And like just to sort of get that story around me is that we recently launched and invested in a swimming franchise. And we discovered how our market here was so tight that there was a recent swimming school was almost 20 miles away. And on one side, it's a hardship. And on the other side, it's a great opportunity. So where I want to maybe steer people is that you're always looking for those opportunistic moments where you can elevate your game to next level, whether it's a different franchise or a opportunity to invest in houses or any other opportunity that you come across. You have to, you know, approach everything with an open mind and learn about it and then go after it. And that's kind of the mindset I keep always, is that never be shy, keep trying, you know. That's kind of always the mindset I approach with.
I like it. So I have a couple questions here as we wrap up. One of which, Sakar, do you have any personal habits or strategies or life hacks, not necessarily real estate related, that helped or continue to help contribute to your success?
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm a big proponent of waking up early, exercising, and doing your goals, like whether it is, you know, you're writing down goals or reading your goals. I'm completely a CrossFit person who goes to CrossFit regularly. I would, you know, shower, that's my 5:30 a.m. That's my 5:30 a.m. class. I got a hit in the morning. I would come back. So by 7:30 or so, I am charged up. I know what I'm doing. I'm a big digital guy, wherein if it's not digital, I want to get it digital, because you can share those things and automate those things. So I do a lot of those things. Those are some of the, you know, so there is the soft side as to how you keep your mind and body in shape. But when it comes down to practical stuff, you want to be, you know, sort of in a digital environment where you are emailing or sharing that or texting those things and things like that. So anything on a paper, if you can convert to a digital, that's the way to go. And I'm a big collaboration guy as well. We use plenty of tools in our business environment where, you know, we try to achieve that balance, basically.
Makes sense. Makes sense. I love hearing the answers for that question there. The other question I have now is a question to answer two ways. One of which would be, well, it's book recommendations. The two different ways would be book recommendations you would make to somebody maybe who's in your position 9 to 5 before you started buying houses. What would those books or book recommendation be? And the second one would be a book recommendation or two to someone who's experienced, like myself, who does 200 plus deals per year.
Sure. So on the newbie side, a lot of it has to revolve around mindset, why things work the way they work. So the first book that I recommend everyone is Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And I'm sure everyone has heard, and if they haven't heard, they should definitely read that book in terms of, you know, the basics of success. And around that basics of success, there are a lot of books around that. Think and Grow Rich. There is Success Principles by Jack Canfield as well. That's another great book, which I believe is a offshoot or has a basis towards Think and Grow Rich, but it's more detailed version. So those would be the two books in the recent years. The One Thing book by Gary Keller and Jay Papasan, that's another great book where the power of focus and how you can pyramid things and create a domino is another great book, wherein it perfectly ties to real estate as well, is that as you start acquiring more real estate and have more cash flow from houses to houses, you can literally chart that how much cash flow you can save and what different things you can do that can be learned off of that. So there is, you know, a lot of those things you can do on an advanced level. If you want to consider another great book is a Blue Ocean Strategy. That book is, I believe by Chan Kim, where it lays out what different strategies you can do. It essentially deals with, blue oceans and red oceans. And to put that in tangible terms, blue oceans would be new markets that you are chartering, whatever new you can do. And red oceans would be doing the same thing that other may have done. So never be afraid to do anything new. And that's why I branched myself into, establishing a swimming franchise. And I cannot tell you, Dan, how many people have thanked me so far that I started a swimming franchise. That basically in life, if you really step back and see, we are rewarded for creation, whether it's something new or whether you're doing something value add service or a product to the market, right? So you have to think from a basis of how I can add value or how I can create something new. And that's the mindset. It's not really about money or capital. Sure, that's your byproduct. But you always want to be thinking that how I can do more, what new can I do, or how can I add value? You know, if you put it in real estate terms, for example, you can also say that, hey, how can I give better service to my tenants and things like that. So when you come from that mindset of thinking, that's where you generate more sort of industry, and industry meaning, you know, you're doing more work, you're doing more exploration and things like that. So I know it's a long-winded answer, but those would be, you know, my sort of thinking philosophy and some books that I can recommend to towards these things.
I love it. I appreciate the answers. I have a whole bunch of takeaways and could go on for 5 minutes right now just from those couple of suggestions, especially the blue and the red, new markets and the creation. That's really
absolutely.
That's really cool right there. So if you could go back and share the crown jewel, how old were you when you came here from India?
Oh, boy. I came probably, I was 23, 24 at the time.
So let's say if you could go back right now, knowing what you know now, and you could share the crown jewel of wisdom with your 23 or 24-year-old self, what would that be, Sakar?
Always try more. It's better to fail and learn. You know, as long as you're doing everything ethical, I would say always try, never be afraid to fail. That's what, to me, that's what everything comes down to, is that in life you take chances, you learn, and, you know, you become a better human being. And as we all know, you know, initially we are feeling our way through, but to a lot of young listeners, whether that means, you know, hey, you are trying something new or driving to new places to find, you know, properties or looking at, let's say, P&L statements to evaluate businesses, things like that, or, you know, doing new ventures. Hey, you will always, you know, the pain of regret is a lot more than, you know, a pain of not trying. So I always say that, you know, never be afraid to try. You know, it's fine if you fail, but, you know, keep trying, keep striving. That's kind of what my mantra is always.
Yeah, and I guess that comes back to the whole scale giving you forgiveness. If there's not an abundance of opportunities, one failure feels like the end of the world. But if you have multiple things going, a lot of irons in the fire, and you fail at a few of them, you got the winners to kind of cover the failures, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And one small point in all this, Dan, also is that keep in harmony with everything. I think one of the principles that Napoleon Hill talks about is that keeping everything harmonious. And whether that means, you know, relations around you, relations with your, let's say, your outside people, whether it's contractors and things like that, a harmonious relationship and a balance has a whole lot more, you know, meaning that it can take you from one place to other. Like having a conflicted mind, or, you know, having what you call a not a clear sense of vision and things like that, always, you know, creates a hindrance. So I always try to keep that harmony all around me so that I can build upon it and do different things. There's no point in, you know, fighting the battles. Nothing really comes out of it unless, you know, something is really obvious. But it's really that building that harmony and supporting each other and moving to the next level. That's really a big, big thing in my book as well.
Sounds good. So if anyone was listening and wanted to get some more information about you, your company, did you care to share some contact info or make an ask or request of our audience, Sakar?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'm very accessible on Facebook. Our company is a Premium Cash Flow Capital. The website is premiumcashflow.com. I can be reached at sakar@premiumcashflow.com. That's S-A-K-A-R at premiumcashflow.com. Or just ping me on Facebook or LinkedIn, and I'm always available. I'm very much accessible. So I'm always, you know, willing to share my ideas or give a thought or help to anything. So I'm readily accessible that way.
Well, Sakar, it's been good. This episode has been full of takeaways and revelations for me, as almost every episode that I've done on the show has been. It's the reason I do the REI Diamond Show, is literally to expose myself and then share with our listeners here the random effective knowledge and the steps that someone like yourself took to get to the place that you're at today. And then so willingly to share that information with us here today. So I appreciate you shutting the door, closing out the distractions, and making the time here to be a guest on our show. I really appreciate you, Sakar.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for having me. It's always great to network, and, you know, look forward to chatting further as well.
And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Have you ever wondered why I do the REI Diamond Show? If you have listened to other podcasts like I have, you probably noticed that most have some type of agenda. Hosts often have advertisers or offer coaching and seminar programs, while I have none of that available here on the show. The REI Diamond Show is and has been a labor of love for me. I love having the guests come on the show and share their jewels of wisdom, and I love sharing those experiences with you here on the show. My life has changed as a result of doing the show, picking up and implementing new strategies, discovering new real estate markets, having access to better investment opportunities, and the list goes on. I am hoping that you receive similar value from your time investment here listening to the REI Diamond Show. Maybe if you have, you wouldn't mind heading over to iTunes, finding the REI Diamond Show, and writing a quick review. I appreciate that effort, and it will help others to find us here as well. And if you haven't already done so, remember to subscribe to catch the next episode. Speaking of the next episode, Tom Shawcross joins us to discuss his rapid entry into the business of rental real estate. Tom has been in the game less than a full year and already has 19 rental units in the Chicago marketplace where he invests. And if you didn't already know, Chicago is one of the best cash flow investment cities in the country right now, even with the high prices, high property taxes, negative population and negative press, it is still one of the cities in the United States which I am most bullish to invest. Tom and I talk deal flow, financing, and our investment philosophies, as in the reasons we buy the properties we buy, so you will definitely want to catch that episode. Now, are you interested in a pre-release of the next episode? That is before the announcement email goes out. When you subscribe on YouTube or one of the other podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher, you'll receive an advance notification as soon as the episodes are published, usually a day or two ahead of that Saturday when the email is sent. If you prefer the email, then just head over to reidiamonds.com and sign up. I am always buying houses, and I am always looking for deals in Chicago, Atlanta, Philadelphia, and Florida. So if you have a deal, preferably one that I can fix and flip, or multifamily units with low rents that I can increase the value of over my ownership, please send it over. You can contact me directly at reidiamonds.com using the form on that page, or you can also check out the available profitable real estate deals that we have available and the entire archive of the REI Diamond Show, totaling more than 132 content-rich, money-making, idea-packed episodes. Are you an accredited investor interested in short-term passive mortgage investment opportunities with double-digit returns? Head over to fundrehabdeals.com to check out available high-yield investment opportunities. That's fundrehabdeals.com. That concludes this episode. Thank you again my loyal listener, for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here, signing off.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.